These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 28th, 2018. It's the last show for this month. I know it was only last week that we told you about Jackie Crowell's relapse with brain cancer, and unfortunately the news is very, very sad this week. Jackie passed away on Wednesday, surrounded by family and friends. You can see all the great tributes to her on her Facebook page and express your condolences if you wish. We certainly send ours to her husband Daniel, her sister Elizabeth, and all of her other family, friends, and colleagues. She was a bright and shining star. One other item I'd like to mention this week before we get on with the show, and that is the upcoming Giro d'Italia. Riders will start leaving for Israel soon, and the first stage, a short time trial, will begin on May 4th. If you heard the conversation that Brian and I had when we returned from riding in Israel back in the fall, you may remember that we rode a lot of the Giro course that the riders will travel, only we were going south to north, and they'll be going north to south. Coverage will be available several ways, including subscriptions at flowbikes.com, F-L-O-B-I-K-E-S. You can download an app from the official Giro d'Italia site, and Fubo TV, F-U-B-O-TV, all one word, will also be streaming the event. The Giro is arguably one of the best stage races in the world, and the world will indeed be watching. So this week, we visit with two very interesting people. Marianne Martin won the first Women's Tour de France, which was actually called the Tour Cycliste Féminine in 1984. Today, she is an incredibly accomplished photographer in Boulder, Colorado, and in our conversation, we look back on cycling in the 80s, how it's changed today, what competitive cyclists might want to think about as far as sponsors and teams are concerned, and about Marianne's unique training regimen back in the day. Then we meet up with a very interesting man, Brandel Randolph. His connection to cycling is rather new, but his background and how he came to the industry is fascinating. Back in 2014, Brandel gave a TED Talk at TEDx Texas Tech University titled, "Stop Throwing Breakfast Sandwiches at the Poor." The meaning of that talk was about how to change the way we deal with poverty and those affected by it. At the time, Brandel was the executive director of Project Poverty in Lubbock, Texas. Now Brandel and his family live in Framingham, Massachusetts, and he has started 1854 Cycling. How Brandel moved from his work at Project Poverty to founder and CEO of 1854 Cycling, and his vision for the company and those he hopes to positively impact is the subject of our conversation. So let's go off to Boulder, Colorado to meet Marianne Martin. Hello, Marianne. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Well, you know, women's cycling is trying to get its footing back into pro racing. I talk to a lot of women who are racers from the past, like you and Karen Bliss and Inga Thompson. And my guess is you have some interesting perspectives on what might be needed to make that a reality today based on what you did. So let's begin with your background, where you grew up, how you came to cycling, and how women's racing looked to you in the 1980s.
Okay. I grew up in a small town in Fenton, Michigan. I wasn't a cyclist then, but I was always athletic. And I got into cycling because I moved to Boulder and I was working as a bartender for the Coors Classic. Oh, wait, it was the Red Zinger then.
Yeah, right.
I saw these cyclists coming in and having so much fun, and I just thought, I'm going to do that. And my friends were cycling, and then these cute boys asked me to go cycling, and it just kind of happened that way. Like, it wasn't, I didn't know really anything about this sport before I got into it, other than it looked like the people were having fun.
Well, we do have fun, right?
That's right. And that's why we need to do it. That's why we do it. That's a reason to do it.
It is a good reason. I mean, it's just not that serious, but it can be, but it's not. So when was this? Put this in the context of time.
That was probably 1980.
So you know Mike Eisner, huh?
78.
Oh,
what's that?
You know Mike Eisner, huh?
Oh, I do. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I haven't talked to him in years, but, yeah, that's really cool. So I read something that you had some issues with your health, with anemia. Tell us about that and how you were able to resolve them to produce the amazing results you got.
Well, so to start with the story of that is that I started cycling. There wasn't really any coaching around it. So I met Andy Pruitt, who was a good friend of a good friend, and he taught me the concept of training. And also, there was somebody else that I met that taught me about intervals. And the reason that's important is because at that moment, I started taking training as a science. Like, I didn't just go ride my bike. Every ride I did had a reason. I took my pulse. I took notes about how I felt. If I wasn't rested, I didn't go hard. I was really meticulous about what I did. And that's one thing I see people not doing these days is they go ride and that's their training ride. Or they might say it's a this ride. But, I mean, I was so specific about it. So then when I had trouble with it, so then fast forward. So I had pretty quick success. And I think it's because I took my training very seriously. So then when I was having trouble with anemia, every spring I'd get anemic. And it turns out I have some blood condition where my blood cells don't live that long. You'd never know it if you had it, if you weren't an athlete or, you know, whatever. But it gave me the reason. But so that year was 84. And when I was having so much trouble, I just said, okay, I'm just going to focus on next year. But what I did then, still, because I was taking my training so scientifically, I did progress really fast when I started doing better. And so all of a sudden I was doing better and it was still the season and there was still a chance I could get on the tour team. And now the year before when I heard there was going to be a Women's Tour de France, that's all I wanted to do. I didn't care about the Olympics, the Worlds, nothing. I just wanted to do the Tour de France. So when I started feeling better, there was one spot left on the tour and I wanted to try to get that. So, anyway, the anemia set me back, but it didn't shut me down.
Okay. Obviously, because you were, your ride in that tour was unbelievable from what I can tell. And it's too bad. Are there videos of it, do you think? Is there any film of it? I know Graham Watson did a lot of photography, but are there any, like, videos? Like, today, everybody would video the whole thing, right?
I don't know. You know, somebody said, I don't know. To answer your question, I don't know. It would be really fun to see if there was, but I have so much memories in my heart. And also because I was a photographer then as well, I got to know all the photographers, or a lot of the photographers at the tour, and they all sent me photos. So I have a really beautiful photo album from that.
Nice.
For them.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Marianne Martin. She is a photographer today. She is just an incredible cyclist from times past, 1984, the very first, and it wasn't called really the Women's Tour de France. It had its own name, the Tour Cycliste Féminine. You stood side by side on the podium with Laurent Fignon. How was that? I'll bet that was cool.
Well, it was a little overwhelming, I have to say. I mean, because the mayor of Paris was there. I mean, everybody was there on the podium, and I was very overwhelmed. And my trophy was heavy, and it was hard to get a grip on, and I was scared to death I was going to drop it.
There's also a picture of you with Jane Seymour. I mean, it doesn't get a lot better than that. She's unbelievable.
She is unbelievable, and she speaks like a million languages. And she was very gracious and fun and funny, and she interpreted for me and Fignon, so we were able to interact, and it was a wonderful evening.
How old were you?
I think I was about 25 or 26.
Okay. So when you look...
A mere child.
A mere child. Yeah, I know. I'm looking at 25-year-olds today going, are you old enough to drive? Really?
I know.
So when you look back at that event, and I know there were probably other events, and I do want to talk about more than just the Tour de France, what were some of the highlights? Because I want to know, was it true that your lowest gear was a 42.21? Is that true?
Well, for the first half, it was a 42.19.
Oh, my God.
Because
Seriously? We
didn't have a lot of support when we went over there, but I do climb a bigger gear when I climb. I'm out of the saddle a lot. I have a very specific climbing style. It doesn't work for everybody, but it works for me. So, yeah, that's what I had. When you're going that fast and hard, you really don't need more than that because you're not sitting down.
No, that's true. But you'd have to convince. You know, it's interesting because I can remember reading the Coney book, and I can remember some of the things Eddie B used to say, and people rode cross country on, you know, a 52.21 or whatever. And it was like, what's wrong with you? You know, these now today, of course, it's like you need a 40 by, I don't know, 34 or something. And then, you know, people are doing these crazy gearings.
I know when I was in the Pyrenees last year with friends and I had, you know, pancakes on the back. And I don't even remember the numbers. It was just too much for me. But I used them all. So I get it that the thought of doing it in the 20, you know, with the 21 is a lot. But it's also, you're training for it. I mean, that's what I did. That was my focus every day, every week. And, you know, my body was ready for that.
Yeah, I get it. Do you remember how many women were in that first Tour de France? Oh, wait, I know that I have an answer, but let me see if you remember.
I do, 36.
Yeah. And were there six Americans?
Yes, there were.
Okay. So each team was made up of six women.
That's right.
They didn't expect you to win, and you did.
They didn't even expect the women to finish.
Of course they
did. Seriously.
Didn't. Why would they, right? Because, of course, we can't
do
anything.
Right.
What kind of bike were you riding? I see you still have the bike because you also have the yellow jersey. I've seen a picture, you know, I don't know if it's a setup picture, if it actually lives that way in your house, but there's a jersey and there's a bike and there's all that. What kind of bike is that? I know it's a steel bike, but what beyond that?
Well, actually, they gave us Vetus's.
And oh, they were aluminum.
Is that an aluminum bike?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's the bike that I'm looking at?
We got it when we got over there.
Ah.
And so I'm glad that it fit me. I since went to a smaller bike, but I do have the Vita still.
Nice. Nice. And you do still have the jersey, no kidding.
Well, I do now. The thing is, we got a new jersey every day. So I ended up with like seven or something, and I gave them to the people that have helped me along the way. And I have one and it's in my closet somewhere.
Wow. What do you remember most about Eddie B?
He's very, we call them the Polish Mafia.
True.
What do I remember? What a good question. I really liked him. I was challenged by some of the way things were done because he's Eastern Europe and they don't think about women the same way Americans do.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we were challenged a little bit. I mean, sometimes I felt like the men's team was what he did and the women were kind of a PS. But I didn't really care that much because I just wanted to raise my bike and I didn't need a lot of help or attention, you know, as far as he was helpful. And actually, Andy Pruitt gave me more information throughout the years than Eddie did. Eddie didn't really coach us a lot, although I bet he did, like Rebecca Twigg and some of the girls he worked real closely with.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. Yes, he did, because I know Inga had her issues with him over the years. Over the years. And I know he was a taskmaster. You know, he was tough. He was tough. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of your thoughts on cycling today and also what you're doing now, which is fascinating work. We'll be right back. We're talking with Marianne Martin. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Okay, we're back. And if you are just joining us, I am speaking with Marianne Martin. She is the winner of the very first Tour de France in 1984 for women. And she lives in, you're in Boulder or are you in Denver? Where are you? You're somewhere in Colorado.
I'm in Boulder. Mm-hmm.
Oh, the Republic of Boulder, as we like to call
that's
that. Right.
Correct,
right?
Yes.
I have a really good friend there. My surrogate son lives there. When you returned from France in 1984, what was next for you? I mean, you weren't done racing right after the tour, were you?
Oh, no. You mean the rest of that year or just in...
No, your career.
Okay. Let's see. I didn't even think of it really as a career. I mean, and winning the tour was not in my whole plan and scheme. So it did kind of... So my friend Patty Peoples, who was at the tour with me, we planned to go to the Worlds and just hang out on the East Coast and race around there. We had a fabulous time, like lots of adventures along the way. And so it was really just, I raced for fun. I raced to see the world and to push my body. And so that was it. It's not like I had really specific goals.
Were you able to make a living racing? Or is that
not
a joke?
Not at all.
Yeah.
No, I was very much in debt when I left. And even winning the tour, we won the team and I won individually and I won $1,000. But I had to share that with my team. So it was not a moneymaker by any means at all. And I even had to pay for my flight to get to New York to go race in the tour. But I didn't really think about, you know, I didn't care. It would have been really nice to have money, but I didn't do it for that reason.
I don't think it's a lot different today. I mean, women try to get on teams today. Sponsorship seems to be a really, really big issue. So do you think women's racing has changed a lot or is it similar? Are you seeing, I don't know if you follow it at all, but I'm sure you're somewhat aware of it.
Well, and I'm not super aware of it, but one thing I've watched a little bit the efforts to bring women into the Tour de France again. And the things that I've read are more about, well, the tour should have women and, you know, all this about you should do this and you should do this. And I don't think people get it that the reason sponsors sponsor sports is because they get something out of it too. And it has to be that something that they're going to get out of it. And it needs to be approached that way. Like, I mean, I do think it's a great opportunity for somebody. If a sponsor did come in and say, we're going to sponsor the Women's Tour de France, there would be so much coverage, and it would be such a niche market. But it's been approached like, you should have women. And, you know, I mean, it's a different mentality, and I don't think they're thinking of what the sponsors need and what the riders need. And it has to be about the sponsors, or they're not going to do it. There's no reason for them to do it.
Well, it's a relationship. And so you're out there with somebody's name on the back of the jersey. There's a reason for that. You know, I put on events, not competitive events, but I always say if your participants are happy, your sponsors are going to get something out of it. Well, in this case, you know, you're sort of the product, and the participant is hopefully the viewer. So I totally get what you're saying, and I agree. It's not just about women. Women need to be, you know, well, I have a whole issue with this Me Too thing anyway. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Right.
That is beside the point. Well, okay, so then the question becomes, do you think if a sponsor showed up, and there are some great women riders right now, would women's racing be elevated to a place where it would be as good or even better than men? Because there's not as much stigma with doping and with the, you know, all the fiascos from the past. I don't know. Do you think women's racing could be as exciting?
I think that's a more involved question. And I think there's certain things that make it more exciting than other things. And I think there's a whole education about the sport. And, you know, despite all the stuff that Lance pulled, he did a lot for the sport. And it could have kept going. And, you know, he did a lot of negative, too. I don't think his fault was in doping, because everybody was doping then. But his fault was in being a jerk about it and lying about it so, you know, so deeply. And I think because of that, it's cleaned up a little bit. But I think that's a hard question. I think there's certain things that could make it a better spectator sport and a better sport for different reasons. So I don't know how to really answer that in a quick sentence.
I can appreciate that. And I'm not looking, I would love a quick and easy answer, but so far, for the last several years, there hasn't been one. You know, I don't know. And I ask a lot of people.
I don't know exactly why that is. And I don't think the women are taking responsibility to make it a better thing, which when you're the underdog, you have to do. You know, nobody else is going to do that for you. I think that's part of it. And we used to do, you know, in the middle of a race, not in the middle of a race, but like between stage races or, you know, Friday night before a race or something, we would go do PR things. And I did a lot of PR things in the days. And I don't know if people are doing that, but I think it takes a lot of that to bring the sport to the people, let them meet you and engage and in different ways become involved in the sport. And that way they can appreciate and get more excited about the racing.
It's interesting you say that, because those are the same comments people make about cyclists just on the road. You know, they're wearing dark glasses, they're wearing helmets, they don't wave, they don't smile, they don't say hello to anybody. And it's like this, a bunch of aliens, you know, riding two-wheel machines and it does change the perception of who and what cyclists are. And it doesn't make it very welcoming.
Exactly. That's so right on. It doesn't. And it's funny because it used to be, like when, you know, back when I was racing, which it's very different now, but, you know, there weren't that many people on the road. But if they waved, you knew they were one of the top cyclists. And if they were unfriendly, you knew they were just, you know, Joe cyclist. Because the great riders, Andy Hampston, Ron Kiefel, they were friendly as all get out. And they would always wave and, you know, chit chat and stuff. It's the people that were the wannabes that were just taking themselves way too seriously that just, you know, give it that different attitude that we don't need.
And drivers pay attention to that. This is why there's so
right.
many.
Right, and also being friendly and courteous right. to the driver.
Right, right. right. Because, flipping them off is not a good idea. No.
Right, exactly.
So are you still riding at all?
You know, I just started riding about 2 years ago.
Atta girl.
I've been trail running. And actually, I quit racing because I was getting sick all the time. And I was sick a lot for 20 years. So for 20 years, I couldn't really work out. That's a different story. But anyway, so about 10 years ago, I got an air purifier and it changed my life. So I started trail running, which I love and I still do. And then I started road riding. My sisters both ride, and it was something we could do together. And then last year, I even went to the Pyrenees with a group of friends and rode, and I love it. But I don't give up my trail running either.
There are no rules that say you can only have one sport, Marianne. I'm sorry.
I'm glad, yes.
So what are you riding these days? What's your bike?
I have a Jameis.
Nice.
Sitting right here, and it's black and white.
Right. Did you name it? I hope not.
I didn't. No.
Oh, good.
I've never named my bike.
Me neither. I don't know. I'm not into that. How about other capacities? Are you doing anything in cycling or in any sport in terms of, I don't know, promoting it or being involved other than just as a participant? Not like that's a bad thing. I'm just wondering. You have a lot to add.
And that's interesting, too, because when I sort of got back into it a couple of years ago, I also started thinking about wanting to do something with it. And I've always wanted to write a book, and I'm working on that. I've always really believed in visualization, because I did visualization, and that's another thing that I know helped me succeed. And I am so surprised that more people don't do visualization.
Interesting,
and,
isn't it?
It's something that I really believe in and would like to teach. So anyway, those things are my involvement, but not as far as coaching or anything else like that.
Yeah, I like visualization. I'm a yoga teacher, so it's sort of out of a different way of approaching it. But it's not really different. It's that clear mind is a good thing, you know, having a clear mind.
Right.
Cool things show up. So, okay, I know what you're doing now. I want you to tell our audience what you're doing now, because the work is just beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm doing photography, and I started getting into photography when I started getting into racing bikes. And my dad was going to give me some money for graduation, and I said, great, Dad, because I want to buy a race bike. So he bought me a camera. So I've been shooting
because he was listening to you.
Since then.
Right.
And what I found I really liked was the people and the emotion more than the speed of the sport. And so that is still what I try to capture. I do portraits and weddings and my makeover portraits with women, where I help them be their most beautiful and do beautiful portraits of women and just help people look their very best in a photograph.
Your before and after portraits. So if anybody is interested, you go to realifeportraits.com. There's a portfolio drop-down menu. Click on before and after, and if you want your mind blown, these photographs are so beautiful. I told her I'm going to fly out to Boulder and have her do one of these for me, just because, you know, it's time that somebody helped me look like that. It is so amazing. And it changes not just the way you look appearance wise, but it's got to change you from the inside out.
It does. And I see that in people, and I see them be so surprised that they're so beautiful. And it's not just about makeup and hair. I mean,
no.
We do work with makeup and hair in a very, very natural way. But it's, you know, one thing is we all fight the camera. So a camera comes up and we're like, oh, I look horrible in pictures. You're fighting the camera right away. Of course you're going to look horrible. So I work with people so that they exude their best instead of exude their resistance.
Well, it's very obvious. There's a new movie out with Amy Schumer about the fact that she's always been kind of chubby and ugly. This is her own perception. I just heard this on NPR yesterday. And she falls and hits her head. And when she wakes up, she believes she's the most beautiful woman in the world. And it's just interesting that we're talking about this.
I've got to see it. It sounds great.
It does sound great, doesn't it? Well,
yeah.
This has just been a wonderful conversation. I wish we had more time. But I have three questions I always ask my wonderful guests. And I want to ask you, what's your favorite food?
French fries.
Good girl. Nobody ever says French fries and means it. That's awesome. And what music do you like to listen to?
You know, I'm so visual. I'm not a big music person. You know, I listen to Van Morrison and Bruce Springsteen, and, you know, I just don't know music very well, honestly.
Wait a minute. I don't have a problem with that. Van Morrison is one of my favorites.
Okay,
you know,
good.
Poetic champions, never mind. All right. And I already must know the answer to this question. Do you have any pets? What a dumb question.
Yes.
Yeah, of course you do. All right. Tell us about your pets.
I have a cute little Jack Russell mix that's sitting right next to me named Piggy. I have half ownership and another sweet little darling bull terrier named Lucy. And I have a horse named Starbuck.
And you keep the horse right there?
No. He's about 9.5 minutes away.
Ah.
But he's out at pasture, so he lives a very fun life. And he's just like a wild horse. And then he's with 20 other friends.
Nice.
Out in the woods.
Big playgroup.
Yeah.
Well, this has just been delightful. I really appreciate you taking time. I know you are busy, and we have it's like taken us 3 months to get this together or something, but now it is together. So thank you for talking with me. I hope you have a wonderful cycling season. It's just happening here in Cleveland, although it's kind of gray and crappy today. It was beautiful yesterday. And thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really been wonderful to talk to you and hear your stories as well.
Will you take care of yourself?
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Marianne Martin joined me from her home in Boulder, Colorado. If you are interested in her work, you can log on to reallifeportraits.com. As I said in our conversation, I love the before and after photos she does. I also really appreciate her perspective on bike racing. So let's take another short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Brandel Randolph about his company, 1854 Cycling, and his vision for helping women earn a living wage. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Last week, I had a chance to have a conversation with my next guest that opened my eyes to how we view and deal with poverty here in the U.S., especially as it relates to women. Brandel Randolph shared his vision for his company, 1854 Cycling, and now I'd like to share it with you.
Hi, Brandel. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure. When Eric Weiss says, you need to talk to this guy, I need to talk to this guy. So your background is so inspirational. I read all about you over the last couple of days. I'd like you to introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us where you grew up, what kind of work you've done, which is a ton, and what inspired you to create 1854, which we'll talk about.
My name is Brandel Randolph. I'm now the founder and CEO of the 1854 Cycling Company. And I was born in Delhi, Louisiana, which is a small town of like a square mile. It literally has two stoplights. And I moved from there to Los Angeles. And then from there, I graduated from the Wharton School of, then all the things happened. It's a whole long story, but started doing research on poverty. And that led to my TED Talk and on poverty and things like that. And then when I moved to the Boston area about 3 years ago, I founded the 1854 Cycling Company.
I'm always impressed with TED Talk people. I think it's so cool that people do these.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I did a lot of research on poverty. And it was a simple story that I told about stop throwing breakfast sandwiches at the poor, which is how a lot of poverty alleviation and effectiveness and things that we want to do for poverty isn't effective because we never stop to ask poor people what they want,
right,
or what they need. We simply throw things at them and, you know, want to feel good about ourselves, but we waste a lot of time and energy and money on things that they really can't use because we never take the time to study poverty for what it is, not outside of our stereotypes and assumptions of what we mean when we say people are poor and they struggle with eating.
I wish we didn't have to talk about bicycles because I would love to talk about this some more, but maybe another time we will.
Yeah, maybe another time. And actually, it all ties in. And I'll tell you why in a moment when we get into 1854.
Yeah, no, it does tie in, and I totally get it. So let's talk about 1854, the name, how you came up with it, why you call it the 1854 Bicycling Company, and then we'll talk about how all of this sort of dovetails into this new company.
Yeah, well, what it is that we landed in a place called Framingham, Massachusetts about 3 years ago. And one of the things about me is that I'm kind of a closet historian, but I love history. And when I found out that a significant, you know, event happened in Framingham, I was so blown away by it, because in 1854 is the year that the second worst president ever brought back the Fugitive Slave Act. What that meant was that people, particularly Africans who had previously escaped from slavery and started new lives in free states like Massachusetts, were able to be put on trial, and if they were found to be escaped slaves, they were taken back. In 1854, on the 4th of July, Sojourner Truth, Henry David Thoreau, and a gentleman by the name of William Lloyd Garrison got together. And now, after all these fiery speeches, Garrison got on to the podium, and he burned the U.S. Constitution. This is kind of like Colin Kaepernick kneeling of 1854. It kind of sent all kinds of people in both directions, whether you're for the cause of abolition of slavery or whether you're for it. And it kind of like galvanized the entire abolitionist movement. And for me, it kind of harkens back to prison recidivism, how a lot of people serve time for even minor offenses, in particular women, but yet this scarlet letter stays over them. And because of the recidivism rates amongst women is so high, it's like they're never, ever free to begin with. And it's kind of like, how do we become the abolitionists of today? How do we ensure freedom permanently for people, like this permanent freedom that we ensure? And I thought that there needs to be a new abolitionist movement. But I want to also harken back to this history that ties into the place where we're founded. So that's why it's 1854.
What a great story. I want to just ask a question about this unbelievable rate of people ending up back in jail, for women especially.
Oh my goodness.
I don't think people look at it like women. Everybody looks at it like, well, it's African-American men. But you're not saying that. Tell me.
Well, what it is that we got the data that says 76% of people are rearrested within 5 years of their previous release from prison, which means that in 5 years, 80% of these people will be rearrested. When we start to look at women in particular, and particularly women who have children, that recidivism rate within 2 years, 2 to 3 years, is almost a staggering 52%, which means that more than half of the women who get arrested, go to jail, and get back out are going to go back in for things like parole violation. And sometimes this is for things simple as not being able to go to work and missing work a couple of days because your child is sick and these jobs that you have don't afford you too many sick days, or not being able to afford, you know, the rent and things like that. So you have to work two jobs and maybe you have to leave the kids home or just being around the wrong crowd. But what happens with women in particular is this whole deal around gainful employment, having enough money to put food and clothes and shelter over the children's back. It's the root cause of a lot of that recidivism amongst them. When we talk about that, it puts everything in a different context, because the unemployment rate for women who are formerly incarcerated is much higher than with men. Also, Framingham is home to one of the largest women's prisons in the state.
Wow.
So a lot of those women stay in the Metro West suburban area where the jobs are more plentiful, or there are more vouchers and things like that, and the schools are better for the kids. So they kind of populate here, and then they make up a large proportion, a disproportionate number of the people who are struggling with poverty in the area. In order to kind of affect poverty in the whole area, we kind of take this disproportionately overrepresented population amongst that crowd, and we sort of see what we can do to affect their lives, to better their lives. This is where we are.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Prandtl Randolph. He is the CEO and owner of 1854 Bicycle Company. We're talking about the people who are going to probably be helped by this company, and we're going to get to that in a moment here. What made you decide that bicycles was the product that you wanted to offer as we move forward talking about your company? What was it about bicycles as opposed to, say, jackets or something like that?
It was very serendipitous. When we arrived in Framingham, I was looking for work or whatever. And so my wife was like, you're much better at having your own business than you are at working for other people. So I wanted to clear my head, and I went to buy a bike, and I didn't see anything that I wanted. So I had a guy make me a bike. And when the bicycle was made, it seems that other people wanted the bike. And I was like, wow, that'd be brilliant to do this. But then I started doing research and I found out what bike mechanics make. Actually, trained, certified bicycle mechanics make about the living wage.
Or less.
or less.
Right.
Or less. But then I found out that on top of that, there's not a lot and there's a huge demand, a growing demand for mechanics who can deal with e-bikes in particular. While everyone can do bikes and chains and fixed tires and those things, the motors and the batteries and those electrical parts that goes with the e-bikes, there's not a lot of people who are certified to do that. So the concept has always been, how can I get the women who I employ to become certified e-bike mechanics? And then how can I pay them enough to afford to one day save up enough to buy their own home? So we have to develop a bit around that goal, being able to hire a dozen, maybe almost two dozen women, and for them to become certified bus mechanics, for us to make a product that people will love, gravitate towards, and also create a skill set for them that's viable for the future. Because I also believe that e-bikes are going to be alternative transportation of the future for a number of people and growing populations, demographics due to health reasons and a lot of infrastructure things such as installing bike lanes and those things that have never had them before. And we want to be at the forefront of this e-bike market. And getting back to the effect of the women, I want them to be a part of it, not as employees, but in part of this growing demographic. Because looking back historically, there have been other industries that particular women in particular have been left out of, whether they're incarcerated or not. And I believe the tech industry is one of them, but I also believe that the cycling industry is another. And we're going to have growing demographics of women who ride bikes, e-bikes. Why not bring in this population of people who need the jobs, who love the jobs, who would work and build their careers from here and help build the company from here? Also give the previously enclosed cycling industry itself a little bit of a feather in its cap. Because the thing about the cycling industry that we've come into mind is that it's been very exclusive, almost cliquey. In a sense. So there's only a certain type of people we view as cyclists, and not everyone who cycles or rides a bicycle feels welcome into it. But now with this company, we have a different way for them to tiptoe into the industry or to the community. And I wanted to give them a bike that they won't be ashamed to ride alongside all the other high-end bikes. But it's a little step up from the big box retailer bikes.
I hope they invite you to Interbike.
Little things that we realized as we were developing our first bike. I know you've been to our site. You've seen the Craft City, for example. It's a Mixty. It's a classic.
Oh, the Mixty. Yeah, no, that's...
A couple of things about that bike that we love. A, it's a straight back riding style. So you can sit straight up in the bike. But also things like the seat. We actually tried to find the most comfortable seat there is because not all women are the same size. And we also have things like the step over and other things, but we also made them smaller too. 50 centimeter, frame, which is also great for women who are a little smaller in stature. A lot of the bikes that are geared towards women right now aren't necessarily for comfort. They're more for fitness and exercise.
I was going to ask about the idea of a living wage. So that is a huge issue in the bicycle business. If you are not the bike shop owner, for example, now you'll be selling your bikes direct, I assume.
Yes.
Okay, so you're not going to deal with shops.
Well, we have a few shops that we're going to put our bike brands in, because the other thing is that we want to kind of create this own ecology here. And the type of shop that we're going to be in are going to be in neighborhoods where people don't, or they can't afford to have the bigger brands in their shop. And so what we're offering is that if you bring the shop, sort of this recycle bicycle shop, you bring in a bike and they'll give you up to off of one of our bikes. One of our brand new bikes.
Right.
That's kind of the program that we're running with these bikes, because they take those bikes, then they refurbish them. These kids work in these shops. And it happens not only just here in Boston. It happens also, I think there's a place in Columbus. I think there's a place in Chicago, Atlanta, and there's one in Watts, California that we want to work with too. These are people, once again, who've been excluded from the cycling industry as a whole. But we generate this love, become an inclusive kind of thing. They become part of the growing demographic of riders that we need to embrace.
Let's go back to this living wage thing for a second. Now,
yes,
you're going to be doing
well,
two things. One is the living wage. The other is the training on the e-bikes. But let's talk about the living wage first. So how are you going to be able to do that?
Actually, this is where our evolution has come in. What we're doing going towards Interbike and what we're doing going towards the fall is that we're introducing the Bosch electric systems.
Nice.
To our frames. So the cost and the price point of our bikes is going to go up But what that allows us to do is to have the margins that we weren't having to do this, because the living wage, based on current calculations, is like almost $20 an hour. But the only way to do that is to have a brand that generates a certain amount of income. And for us to have the capacity with the brand, we have to create a niche for ourselves within a certain price point and demographic. And the only way to do this in the next 3 years is to go through high quality e-bike systems. Not only are we looking towards doing sort of these commuter e-bikes, but, you know, they're going to be great design. We're also looking at going towards the cargo bike with an electric mid-drive motor as well. We're also looking to go back towards the electric mountain bike. So we're going to have a full fleet of electric mountain bikes, and the price points for those are going to be quite significant. But the difference is between our company and other companies that we're not going to be paying exorbitant salaries to 3 or 4 executives. It's going to be spread out across these 24 employees. If you're talking about paying executives mid six figures versus paying 20 women who could use a great salary for what we do, now we're talking about a company that has some legs, but also has some kind of pride amongst its employees. Now those women can actually afford to actually save up some funds to one day own a house, which is, you know, some of their dreams, or to do whatever they need to do. Things that for a lot of them was previously taken away simply because of minor things like being associated with the wrong or running with the wrong crowd. Because a lot of these women are not violent offenders. Actually, none of them are violent offenders. Most of them are, I don't want to say victims, but they were affected by the drug industry. So we talk about the opioid crisis or the marijuana industry and those things like that, but how many women have been locked up for being associated with someone who was associated with these kind of situations now who just need a chance? And then I must say, we're not talking about women who have those skills. A lot of these women, when you look through their resumes, have college degrees. They have years of employment under their belt. They are people who were probably previously working before something unfortunate happened, which is the myth of what we think about when we think about formerly incarcerated people.
Right.
We don't think about the people who were going to work, who were working as secretaries or in logistics or FedEx or these other places. And maybe the boyfriend did something, you know, or the husband did something, and everyone gets in trouble according to some state laws. And this is how it works in America. But we never talk about those women, which make up a huge disproportionate amount of the women who are not only incarcerated presently, but who are formerly incarcerated, who are now kind of their ceiling there of how much they can earn, kind of sad. And they talk about those women who can only earn $8 to $10 an hour. Talk about that being a lifestyle and having children under the age of 18. And being a parent myself, I can't imagine what it's like to try and feed out on $8 an hour.
Yeah, right. So let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll ask Brandel some more about how 1854 Cycling is going to train these workers and what his vision is for the future. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back, and if you're just joining me, I'm talking with Brandel Randolph. His company, 1854 Cycling, is producing bikes in the Framingham, Massachusetts area, and we're going to pick up our conversation about training for his employees. Where are you getting the information or the training? I imagine Bosch will give them some training, but how are you going to train on these e-bikes? Is that it, on e-bikes? Yeah.
Yeah, because they do training. They come out. They're a really awesome company. In this factory that we're setting up now, we're looking at building our own frames. And they're going to come to the factory at least twice a month, do our training, do our certifications, do quality, help us with quality control and all those other things, and make sure we have all the equipment in the factory that we need to actually produce a quality product. Because it's not just a good look for us, it's also a good look for Bosch as well. Here is something we can do ourselves. We were able to create what I think is going to be an amazing venture with this factory. We'll be able to service local dealers and retailers for Bosch equipment too. So the shop where they will send their e-bike systems to get repaired or get maintenance would be our shop. And that also creates work for our employees. So I think it's a great way to go.
I was going to ask how big the new factory is.
Well, we're looking right now at about 40,000 feet.
40,000?
Yes.
Wow, that's huge.
Yes, we're looking at about 40,000 square feet. We're looking at about 25 to 30 employees to start. We probably won't fill out the entire space for the first like 1 or 2 years.
Right.
But we're looking at growing into the space, which is going to be great if we take off. Because of the way that things are right now in terms of tariffs and other things, we're kind of trying to make sure that we're going to ensure that we have the demand for the bikes that we need to sustain the operations and all that. So what we're working on now is being able to debut our future fleet that we're going to be releasing in 2019 that are going to be made in our factories, that we're going to try and produce about 2,000 to 3,000 bikes a year for the first 1 or 2 years. But then after that, as demand increases, we want to increase capacity to doing that in about every month. And we think that this way of doing American-based manufacturing is going to be the only way we're going to survive in this changing economy of ours.
Well, I really like your vision because it encompasses so many things, not just the manufacturing and distribution of what I think is a really important category in our business, but the way you're approaching the business model where the CEO does not have to sit around watching his employees work while collecting a huge paycheck to the detriment of the people who are making it happen. So, it's an altruistic way of looking at it. I don't think a lot of companies are willing to do that. The last thing I want to talk about for right now is, who is your customer? Who do you think is looking for this bike?
Right now, I can assure you, my customer is not your traditional cyclist. I was really thinking about this because I saw it as something that I think my typical customer is a person who does not feel a part of the cycling industry. The best way to put it is, I don't think my typical average customer wears spandex on the weekends.
Not what we call a mammal.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, my customer is not going to go and ride. My customer is really the person who takes the bike out and they want to go to work every now and then. They want to stay in shape and they want to look good and show up at work and not be sweaty. My customer wears their work clothes on this bike, rides it to work, arrives and rides it home. They take the cargo bikes and they put their kids in it or their seniors or whoever, and they ride this bike and they feel just as proud riding this bike as they do anything else. You know, and my customer has a sense of flavor and style to their dress, their appearance. They don't want to fit in at all. They're the kind of people who kind of buck the status quo, but they also want every purchase to mean something. Someone said it best, says, your customer is the kind of person that brags about buying Tom's shoes, as ugly as they are, because they mean something.
It's like old Doc Martens. I thought they were ugly, too. Yeah, I get it. Doc Martens.
Yeah, Doc Martens. Exactly. Right. Like, that's your customer. Your customer is the person that's going to explain what 1854 means to someone else.
Right.
And they're going to go, great. They're the people who wear my hoodies and my t-shirts and ride my bikes right now, and they tell everyone about it. Like, they're posting their pictures of their bike on Facebook, and they're posting it elsewhere, and it's generating calls and emails from people and this and that, and I'm sending bikes all across the world now because people see it and things like that. But my customer are the people who don't see themselves on a bike in a cycling community traditionally.
Right. I got it.
And I want to show that in my ads when we bring out the new bikes and things like that. But I want people to feel included, like this is a norm. This is what's cool. This is what's hip. And I'm seeing that that's going to be a great demographic where I can place my niche, because remember, I don't have to sell thousands and thousands upon thousands of bikes to make a profit like some of the other brands. And so if I hit this market and hit it well, these people who I'm talking about can get their paychecks every single month for the next 10, 20 years. And that's really what we're talking about, because if I'm successful, but I haven't employed 25 to 30 people or 25 people or at least to work into this factory, then I have not done my job. If I'm successful and I'm taking a multi-million dollar salary, but yet they're still not at this living wage that I promised, then I am not successful. I'd rather take no pay and make sure they're paid so they can feed their children than to actually do this and, you know, in other ways. And I kind of want to make sure that it's done and done well. And when it's executed, there is no way that this is not going to continue for at least a couple of years. That's why I'm very slow and methodical with opening the factory, taking pre-orders and things like that prior to. I mean, I'm even more methodical about going to Interbike without having my prototypes with me, because I know that once I get to Interbike and I do whatever I do, we're going to get those orders. But when I can fulfill those orders will be the pinnacle of how we do what we do in our next wave of things. But I definitely think that in the next 2 years, we'll be a huge bike company here in America.
Well, I'd like you to tell my listeners how they can find out more about your company, and then I'm going to ask my usual three questions that everybody wants to know. They're so mundane, but whatever.
That's okay. I love those questions, by the way.
Okay.
Right now, you can go to my website at 1854cycling.com, and on there, you can see all of the bikes and clothing that we have for sale right now. That's probably the best place to get us.
Where can they hear your TED Talk? Tell them the name of your TED Talk, because I think that's really fascinating.
And you can Google my name, Brandel Randolph, and the TED Talk is Stop Throwing Breakfast Sandwiches at the Poor. It's at TEDx, Texas Tech University, and it was probably 13 or 14.
And we're still doing it.
And we're still doing it, yes. And, you know, there are articles on me in Bloomberg. You can Google. WCBV Chronicle here in Boston, Channel 5, did a TV show on the town of Framingham, and I'm featured there for about a good 20 minutes talking about all this stuff. And
fascinating guy.
Some of the events. And hopefully, I do get the call to come to Interbike and speak a little bit. That'll be awesome.
Well, you know what? Let's see what happens. I think it would be good. Interbike is struggling right now, and I think one of the things it's struggling with is who is its customer A, who's selling bikes to that customer B, and why everything is run by 25-year-old product managers C. And that needs to change. And so as that changes, as our demographic changes, as the people see that it's a different customer than they've been targeting all these years and a different model, I think that they'll begin to see that they have to change what they're offering at the trade show. So
that would be awesome.
Yeah. What's your favorite food, Brandel?
Stereotypically, fried chicken.
You didn't have to be stereotypically, but all right.
I'm kidding. Yeah, no, I'm from Louisiana, and it's sad because I only like my fried chicken like one way. Okay, you have to put it in the grease on the flour, and it's a whole other conversation. You can't bake it. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I got it. Fried chicken, I think by definition, is fried. So, what music do you like to listen to?
I'm a nouveau jazz person now.
Nice.
I listen to, there is an artist, his name is Kamasi Washington. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
And Robert Glasper. These are guys who have been winning Grammys for years. They are amazing. And they have this blend of like jazz and rock and roll and soul and blues all in their stuff now. And it's this great genre. And I just love it. And it's behind a lot of the other genres that we hear now. But yeah, nouveau jazz is like my thing now. Marcus Strickland, Robert Glasper.
Oh, I actually have one of Robert Glasper's albums, interestingly enough. I do. Well,
he is amazing.
Album's the wrong thing. I bought it and downloaded it, so I don't actually have a physical, you know, like anything, which is so annoying sometimes. So do you have any pets besides two children?
Yes, I do. I have two dogs. They're both rescue animals. I have one elderly. She's a Lhasa Apso. Way from this. And then my other is a Basenji. And
those
are my two dogs, Max and Gertie.
So your Basenji does not bark. Is that correct?
My Basenji howls.
Interesting. Aren't they supposed to be African barkless dogs?
Yes, they're supposed to be, but this one came from Texas, and it keeps us up at night because it's not used to the turkeys walking around the yard, so we have to figure something else out.
Well, Brandel, this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you taking so much time, and I wish you a lot of luck with 1854 Bicycle Company. I will be watching it as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful afternoon.
Right. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Brandel Randolph joined me from Framingham, Massachusetts.
If you are interested, you can see some of the bike models at 1854 Cycling Company. You can also watch Brandel's TED Talk on YouTube. It is titled, Stop Throwing Breakfast Sandwiches at the Poor. So thanks to both Brandel and Marianne Martin for two terrific conversations this week. And thank you for listening to the show. Remember to like us on Facebook, where you can join the conversation or start a new one. The Outspoken Cyclist is on Twitter at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. And if you like the show, won't you please rate it on your favorite podcast app? So I hope you have a great week. Remember, stay safe. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.